Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, we have a somewhat ambitious episode tonight of six films. I've seen four, but I believe you've seen all six. Three that actually will be in normal mainstream theaters and three smaller docs.
Yep, I have seen all six.
And I know you feel overwhelmed by that right now, and it's technically your own fault. It would have been five. I forced one on you. You forced one on me.
Uh-huh.
Very well. So let's start out with the wine this evening.
It's a Red Diamond Merlot. I know exactly what that one's referring to.
Do tell.
I believe it would be in reference to the biggest heist movie of the week, Ocean's 8.
I like how you say the biggest heist movie of the week, because there's actually two, and it's fortuitous. We're going to talk about them close together, and I love that we're talking about two heist movies, but we'll talk about the biggest one, and it's already had its Thursday night preview, and it's supposed to make $144 million this weekend. That's more than Solo, a Star Wars story. We're talking about Ocean's 8. Ocean's 8 is probably the first time we've had an all-female lead ensemble in a large caper, a large heist. We've seen this done many times with men, and I'm not just talking about The Sting, but even its direct connectors, 1960s Rat Pack, Ocean's 11, and the early 2000s Ocean's 11, 12, 13, Clooney, Brad Pitt, and company.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gary Ross, writer-director Gary Ross, comes along. He's like, you know what? Why don't we try this with female leads? He's right that it will make a lot of money. However, I'm on board that we're watching strong A-list females steal things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good idea. But why not create a fresh one, an original one, a creative one? They have the muscle in Hollywood to do this. But instead, they remade Ocean's 11.
No, they didn't. It's more like a spin-off.
It's the same cinematic style, the same musical little bass line in the back. It's the same arc.
But it's not like when they redid Ghostbusters with women, where they were truly trying to reboot with the exact same film with women instead of the men. This, I like that they at least found a way to potentially connect the Ocean's 11 crew with the Ocean's 8 crew.
They did connect it. Debbie Ocean, the sister of Danny Ocean. Danny Ocean is Clooney. Debbie Ocean is Sandra Bullock, America's straight-up sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little shocking for the first 10 minutes. America's sweetheart is in prison. She's in front of the parole board. I've changed. Let me out. I will do good. I just want to pay my bills. And she immediately does something that Danny Ocean never did. Danny Ocean was suave. He didn't stoop so low. Debbie Ocean steals. She goes to stores and she shoplifts, and she goes to hotels and steals suitcases and fur coats. And could you imagine Brad Pitt or George Clooney doing that in their films?
No, but she's suave in her own way and sharp and smart about her thievery. And so I think it was just designed to quickly set up that she's got skills.
She has incredible skills, and I guess it does run in the family. She's she has an elaborate scheme, a plan that she spent 5 years in prison perfecting. She says after 3 years, she wasn't getting caught in her head anymore. This is ironclad. She's going to put together a crew. She says she only needs seven, Ocean's 7. The eighth one will come along later. And here's why, when the credits rolled and we were talking about this, I said, Hannah, is Ocean's 8 sexist? The men, they get to go to Vegas. They get to rob casinos and magnates. And they even went to Venice and robbed a whole bunch of Venice stuff. And then they went back in Ocean 13 and robbed Vegas again. Why do the women have to rob a fashion gala?
Oh, I don't think it's sexist.
Why do they have to rob jewelry?
I think it's designed. It's a means to an end, and I think it's a perfect setting.
Can women not rob casinos?
No, but while her brother is the casino robber, she has this great plan for robbing jewels. And, you know, they say diamonds are a girl's best friend, and so they're robbing diamonds, and the Met Gala...
So they're feeding a stereotype. Diamonds are girls' best friend. Girls must love diamonds.
Oh, come on. But the Met Gala, as we learned in the documentary First Monday in May, is the event for the fashionistas and the celebrities. And so it also presented a great opportunity to just showcase some great fashion. And so it's not sexist. I think a lot of women will enjoy seeing that aspect of the setting that we're sort of privy to by going inside the Met Gala and kind of witnessing a potential heist that will go on.
I'm glad we saw the documentary The First Monday in May, because they put the words up on the screen, The First Monday in May. But they actually don't tell you what that means. Vogue magazine, Anna Wintour, puts on one of the most scrutinized events on Earth, the first Monday in May, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in Manhattan. The who's who of the world is there, and it's funny that Rihanna is in this film, because she's usually a number one at the Met Gala. And this is another, once again, Vogue magazine gets another movie. The September issue, The First Monday in May, the Gospel According to Andre, which we just talked about 2 weeks ago, and now Ocean's 8, Anna Wintour's in this movie.
But the difference is, this is the one people will actually see.
Ooh, burn.
Come on. I mean, seriously, those others, I mean, yes, maybe you would see the documentary First Monday in May. The other ones, very, very slight chance that many people who will go see Ocean's 8 will have seen those other fashion docs.
And every facet of the room, of the museum, of the red carpet are covered by cameras. How is this crew, this intrepid crew, going to steal this one necklace, this one Cartier necklace worth $150 million? It's not just lying on a mannequin, it's not lying on a table, it's on someone's neck. In fact, it's on Anne Hathaway's neck. And they have to do the old switcheroo, the old 1-2 during dinner to steal a $150 million Cartier necklace. And to do that, she has Kate Blanchett, they're in the same kind of second-in-command role. Helena Bonham Carter is going to design Anne Hathaway's dress. She gets into the ball. Rihanna is the hacker, the cyber girl. She's funny. She gets one of the – I think she does get the film's best line. Mm-hmm. And the other seven, they're there. They're rounded out, but they're minor. Sarah Paulson, somebody named Awkwafina.
I know. I've never heard of Awkwafina.
I have no idea who that is. And Mindy Kaling.
And Mindy Kaling, yeah, as a sort of a jeweler who's going to be able to recognize.
So the crew is cheeky. Mm-hmm. And the actual heist and how they do it is, I guess it's innovative. Okay, that would work, I suppose. But it's exactly what they did in Ocean's 11, 12, 13.
Yeah, but it's similar. It's sort of same song, different verse. And I think people are going to be okay with it. I heard from folks who were going to say, you know, they said if they saw Book Club a couple weeks ago with a more mature ensemble of A-list women, then this was another one that was sort of appealing to them, that this was another A-list ensemble of younger women. And the fact that there's nothing new here, but it's still an entertaining heist movie, and it's a fun crew to watch. We just saw George Clooney today or yesterday just got this AFI award for like life achievement stuff. And
because he's so old.
And so I know, it's really scary. But, just to even see him this weekend as this movie's about to come out, it's a reminder of just kind of how much fun it would be, I think, to see Clooney, to see the Sibs, the Ocean Sibs get together, and to see an Ocean's movie that combines your Ocean's 11 guys with your Ocean's 8 women. Because I do think that that it's just one of those types of films that's just, it's a fun watch. And so you just kind of take it for what it is.
Yeah, it almost sounds like one of those a Justice League or an Avengers Infinity yeah. War. And finally, they will bring them all together in the same film.
It could be, but, you know, all we see of George Clooney in this film, well, okay, I won't say what.
We don't want to spoil it, but the end shot, the last shot of the movie is actually somewhat off-putting. The credits start to roll and you're like, that's an odd choice, sir.
Well, I think there's always that potential for where this could go. And if these women do really well, you know, hey, then you might see an Ocean's 9.
Well, it sounds like they are going to do very well. This is directed by Gary Ross. He created one of my favorite movies of all time, Pleasantville. I love that movie, and that was his first movie. He went on then to do the first Hunger Games, and that's the only one in the series he did. So he knows how to make a movie. And his executive producer is Steven Soderbergh. What did Steven Soderbergh create? Oceans 11, 12, and 13.
Well, and that's why you needed to have some sense of continuity and understanding of the tone. And I think that was important. And I think that's why this film worked.
Soderbergh provided the coloring book and Ross colored it in.
But hey, you know, it's not the first time that that's happened. And at least they're acknowledging the best aspects of what makes like an Ocean's 11 work. And that, you know, really is just that it's designed to be an entertaining heist flick with just a really cool group of women.
Our second film is close, but not so close. And I'm not going to talk about the other heist film right now. I'm going to talk about the one that you saw that I didn't see. It's called Hotel Artemis, and it's another ensemble. So we have back-to-back large cast ensemble. So since I didn't see it, I went to go check out the page. It's directed by a man named Drew Pierce, and he's more known as a writer. He wrote Iron Man 3 and Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Those are not easy films to write, since they are sequels of sequels. And the ensemble is odd. And I can't wait for you to tell me if it works, if it doesn't work. Because I'm talking about Jodie Foster, Sterling K. Brown, Jeff Goldblum, Jenny Slate, and Zachary Quinto, who we just saw together in Aardvark, or I just saw together in Aardvark, Charlie Day and Dave Bautista, the guy from Guardians of the Galaxy. That is, on paper, a very odd cast.
And it's that cast on paper that propelled me to go see this movie, even though the premise did not really appeal to me in the trailer. I was a little like, I'm not so sure about this one. But then I thought, my goodness, this cast, how did they get, there has to be something here if you got Jodie Foster to lead this cast. I mean, she hasn't really been in a major motion picture since 2013, I think. So it's been a little while. And so I went into this kind of thinking, all right, let's see what they got. And it was fascinating because it was almost like a B-movie wannabe with this great cast. And that's what makes it suddenly kind of work and be an entertaining movie it definitely is quirky. It's a little odd. Dave Bautista is probably, I would say, next to Jodie Foster, the most memorable character in this film. Sterling K. Brown has a pretty significant role, too. But Jodie Foster plays this woman known as the Nurse. And for 20-some-odd years, she has been running this sort of rundown hotel/emergency room for wounded criminals, like a secret place that you had to have a membership to get into.
It sounds like a takeoff of John Wick.
Exactly. But it's also set in the future. So this is set, I think, in like 2028, and there's a riot going on in Los Angeles. And so it's really this one night in this hotel where they are basically filled to capacity on this floor where they where this one nurse treats everybody who comes in. And it's just, there's a lot of bloodshed. This hotel has three very basic rules, and it's like no guns, no cops, and no killing the other patients. And
let's just say, I bet some rules will be broken.
Let's just say on this particular night, rules get broken, blood gets shed, and it's just a very intriguing drama that you just kind of watch and wonder who's going to survive this night. And yes, it is exactly like the hotel, the Continental Hotel that you see in the John Wick movies, which has always been a fun element of those John Wick movies where you've got this hotel for assassins and there are rules when they check in and you can't assassinate any of the other hotel guests. But whereas the Continental Hotel is a very upscale hotel and people usually walk in and out of there without bleeding quite so much, this one really is basically a hotel that doubles as a as an emergency room with this one woman who is trying to keep the rules. And she's a hard ass. She's fun. She's she's this strong character who doesn't take crap from any of the mafia dudes, the criminal bosses that come in. And so she really has the respect of this criminal element. And as the story unfolds, you learn what her motivations are for being there and what the motivations are for each of these guests that that pop in throughout the evening. And so I think you would have liked it. I actually thought that it was a bit of a shame you missed it, because I do think this would have kind of been a pleasant surprise for you.
This sounds way more like my movie than yours. And on paper and from your description, it sounds awesome. I mean, and it's not getting the greatest reviews I've ever seen. But it sounds, so maybe it's not executed as well as it's talked up, but it sounds amazing.
It really is decent. I was surprised that, surprised and not surprised. I mean, really, with that cast, you can't go wrong. And it's the performances. It's when you've got Jodie Foster sort of kind of controlling the atmosphere and the vibe and the dialogue. She still holds her own really well, and so she makes, and the other cast members doing such strong performances make this unbelievable story a little more believable. Even Jenny Slate, who sort of hit or miss for me sometimes, she has a small but intriguing role in this film, and it's kind of like an episode of The Love Boat where you just had like a gazillion really strong character actors suddenly showing up.
You're the only reviewer who saw Hotel Elvis is going to tie it into The Love Boat.
I know, but it's just like they're all in one place for one night. And
one magical night.
And you have just these really strong characters, and it's not a great movie. It really is like watching a B movie. It just happens to have some really good actors at the helm.
Well, there you go. I'll red box it when it's red boxable. Mm-hmm.
And that's
Netflix.
Fine.
I'm all for it.
Yeah, but you can wait. It's just one that while the premise might not seem all that appealing on the surface, it's actually a decent watch.
All right, next up is our second heist film. Certainly not as big as Ocean's 8. It's not going to make $144 million, but people are talking about this. We're talking about American Animals. American Animals showed up at Sundance this past January, and it didn't have distribution, so they're shopping it around. Who's going to take it? And MoviePass took it. Their first film they bought, yeah. MoviePass, which is the deal where for $10 a month, you can go to one movie a day. It's like 30 or 31 films a month just for $10. So technically it's for free after you do your $10. So MoviePass went out and bought a movie, and they're distributing it, and it's, in my opinion, I think it's a very good film. It's getting mediocre reviews, but I really latched on to this film, and I'll tell you why. It's not because of the plot. Compared to Ocean's 8, which is slick and has a plan, the heist in this film technically has a plan, but it's not slick. It's undergraduates who Google, how do I pull off a heist?
And they watch a lot of Hollywood movies about pulling off a heist.
Yeah, because how do you learn? You watch movies. I didn't know this university exists, but it's real. In Lexington, Kentucky, Transylvania University has a special collections room in their library, as most libraries do in universities. They have a first edition Audubon, American Birds. They have a first edition Charles Darwin. They're going to steal these books, and they're going to Google and somehow find a fence and make millions of dollars. They're disillusioned by college. They thought it was going to be something different, and they learned, wow, freshmen in college are nobodies. We mean nothing. I was told I was going to be special. I was going to be somebody, and I'm nobody. So they have this really weird philosophy where they're just going to do this one heist, sell these books on the black market and just drop out. They just, you know, get their $12 million each and just drop out. So the plot, we've seen this before. It's kind of a throwaway plot. I don't care about bored, jaded white boys stealing something and pulling off a heist. I loved the filmmaking. Bart Layton, writer-director Bart Layton. And this is a true story.
He adapted it for the screen. Yeah, I was about to say, you're missing the key point of this is that it's a true story. It actually happened.
Well, a couple years ago, he made a documentary that's on the verge of being a cult classic. It's called The Imposter, which when you watch this movie, you're like, oh my Lord, I cannot believe that happened. This true story called The Imposter, and I won't tell you any more after that. That's how mind-bending that documentary is. And what he did, Bart Layton, was he hired actors, not necessarily look-alike actors, but actors to play the four kids, college kids in this heist. And then he brought the four now men, and they tell their story at the same time. So you have kids acting out what these men are talking about on screen. And their memories are different. One guy remembers, well, I came up with the plan in the car. And the other guy remembers, no, he came up with the plan on the balcony. And they can't remember who the ringleader was. And it, you know what? Human memory is fallible. People do remember things differently. But the editing and the directing is so shifty. And that's sleek. That it's almost sleeker filmmaking than Ocean's 8.
Well, I mean, it's a hybrid because you have this intercutting of the real life, you know, folks who pulled this heist off or attempted to, I should say. You know, and that's intercut with the dramatization part of it with these four actors. And what's interesting is that the director did not let the actors meet their real life counterparts.
That's a good idea.
Until after filming was done and the movie was done. And so I kind of get it. It's intriguing to think how they might have played things differently if they had met them. But the director didn't want the actors to have any preconceived notions or to feel any responsibility towards the individual guys that they were playing. And so that's interesting. It's definitely a grittier heist movie than Ocean's 8. And the fact that it's based on a true story is fascinating. I certainly don't really remember hearing much about this.
Never heard about this. No. Well, it was 2004.
2003, 2004.
And I was out of the country anyway, but no, I did not hear about this.
Yeah, and I just don't recall hearing much about it. And so it's always interesting to me to see these based on true stories. And this one's unique in that it does have the real players intermixed with the actors. And the director is actually somebody who has a docudrama series background. So he did that Locked Up Abroad series. And so I could see elements of that reality show kind of storytelling going on with the way this movie is cut. And so it's certainly different. I know you gave it a much stronger review than you gave to Ocean's 8.
I did.
I would not have done that. I do think they have separate audiences. MoviePass.
I don't care about the audiences. I care about the films.
But MoviePass, they took this one on because you are their target demo. They were going for the millennials.
I'm not a millennial.
Yeah. Close enough.
How young do you think I am?
Yeah, the millennials are like in their 30s.
I am not a millennial.
So I just think that that it's targeting completely different audiences. And so I don't think that one movie is so much better than the other. I think Ocean's 8 is a much more entertaining film, and it does have the slicker movie making to it. And so this one is, it's an indie heist movie.
It shouldn't have the slicker filmmaking.
I know
the budgets compared to why would it have the slicker filmmaking?
And no,
because
it
can't. It's the director, I believe, is stronger.
I don't think so, because I truly felt that I was watching what felt to me like a special documentary where they do the dramatizations, where it was just a notch above with the dramatizations that are done while you're telling the story with the real guys who were involved. And so I don't think it's I don't think the direction is better. I think they're just so different.
Well, did you notice the casting? Layton didn't hire the best looking kids, and he didn't hire kids that kind of look like the real life guys. In fact, they looked nothing. The main guy, Spencer, who played by Barry Cohane, who we saw in Dunkirk, he was Georgie, who got hit on the head.
Oh, right.
He looks nothing like the real life Spencer. Nothing. And you know, the real pretty boy is Blake Jenner. the getaway driver. We saw him in Everybody Wants Some and The Edge of 17.
Yeah.
What he did was he hired really good actors. These kids are awesome. Evan Peters is the wild one. He was Quicksilver in the X-Men. Mm-hmm. Like especially Days of Future Past one. These are great young actors, and they're not, and I'm glad he chose to do that. Hire the best actors, not the lookalikes.
No, it's all those things combined, though, make this a smaller film. And so it's going to...
It's going to be a sleeper hit.
It will be a sleeper hit. I definitely think it's interesting. I wish that it wasn't out necessarily the same week as Ocean's 8.
No, it opened limited last week.
But certainly if you want an alternative heist movie that isn't as big and splashy and mainstream and with more testosterone than estrogen in it, then American Animals is the one.
There's not a lot of testosterone in American Animals, I'm
just
saying. Oh,
come on.
All right, the first of our three documentaries is the biggest one. This was a Sundance splash. Some say a Sundance weeper. And only you saw it. I did not get to see this. But I really, really, really wanted to because it's about a man that we all, if some of us didn't necessarily grow up with him, we know who he is. And we just like listening to him. Everyone likes listening to Fred Rogers. Even, I guess, Podcat in the background who's hitting himself against the window playing with a ball right now. Tell me about Won't You Be My Neighbor?
It is a great documentary. It's an homage to Fred Rogers and his show, you know, Won't You Be My Neighbor, which aired on PBS basically from, I think it was like 1968 to 2003, maybe, or 2001, because I think he died in 2003. But it is a worthy homage to him. It was directed by Morgan Neville, who did 20 Feet from Stardom.
He has an Oscar.
He has an Oscar, and that was a great, you know, I love 20 Feet from Stardom, so I figured he can probably do well with this material, and he does. I mean, it's not a great documentary, but it's such a great subject, and it's such a good time to really shed light on a guy whose sole purpose was saying, look, we need to do better by the kids, and we need to be able to use public television as a tool for children. Oh my goodness, the cat is
I'm throwing things at the cat now.
the cat's going getting nuts. Scared. I do think I remember watching Mr. Rogers, and I don't remember the specifics, but it just was a very calming kind of show, and he spoke to kids on their level in a way that they could understand. And his messages were about compassion and using your imagination and being kind and kind of relaying what was happening in the real world to what he was doing in his make-believe neighborhood. And, you know, it was a very, he really launched his show in a very turbulent time in the late 60s. And they dealt with things like Bobby Kennedy's assassination.
Yeah, you have a sock puppet saying, what's assassination?
Yeah. And so it really is just the documentary. It explains and it validates everything that you kind of always remembered and felt about Fred Rogers. And he was like an ordained minister, and he had child psychology experience.
Yeah, he was an ordained Presbyterian minister, but no one thinks about Fred Rogers as converting anybody or mm-hmm. selling religion. And is this documentary going to come off as overly religious? Are churches going to buy out theaters?
No. In fact, it's such a small – this is really ultimately about – this guy's genuine desire to make things better for children and to help them deal with whatever was happening in the real world. And I mean, the Challenger explosion, 9/11, he kind of came in at all of these junctures with just a very accessible way to kind of let kids know not to be scared and what was going on in the world. And giving them sort of an outlet, a way to feel okay about being who they are. And it's just this great message. I think that's why people probably, you know, would stand up and applaud at the end of this documentary. It's just that, wow, you know, especially right now when there's all this just incivility going on in the world, this documentary is really just talking about kindness, you know, just showing, taking a moment and thinking about showing kindness and compassion and liking people just the way they are. And it's just a great message. And so you can't argue, no matter whether you love the film itself or not, you can't argue with what it's trying to do. And Tom Hanks is doing a dramatized version. He'll be playing Mr. Rogers in a film next year. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not this sort of love for Fred Rogers carries over through that film.
Well, I think there's a lot of room in 2018 for Fred Rogers. We could use some Fred Rogers right now, and I hope this spurs some sort of nostalgia or even a second wind. Mm-hmm. Get some reruns on television.
Yeah, because there isn't another. I mean, that's what you realize, too, is that he was such a unique individual, and there really hasn't been anyone to take his place. And he's single-handedly one of the best parts of the film, and it was also in a PBS documentary that ran a few months ago, is really how in 1968 he went in front of a congressional subcommittee on communication, and basically single-handedly saved funding for public television when Nixon was going to cut it because he needed the money for the Vietnam War. And he just made this impassioned plea, and it swayed Republicans and Democrats alike. And it was like, oh, if only they could put this on a loop and show this to every congressional hearing and everyone delivering testimony these days as to how just passionate he was about what he was doing and just making other people understand it too.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the major arc of the show and how it was groundbreaking in its various scenarios. And I remember, I don't know if it's in the film or not, was when he shared a baby swimming pool with an African-American, and they mm-hmm. both put their feet in the same pool. And how the actor at the time is like, I didn't know what I was doing. And only later did I realize what that meant for America. And he's like, that's just a genius move. And you mentioned Morgan Neville, the director who he won his Oscar for 20 Feet from Stardom. I was bummed about that because I didn't really care about that documentary.
Oh,
he made a much better documentary, and we were just talking about AFI docs. This was the opening one 2 years ago. He made Best of Enemies, Buckley versus Vidal.
Oh, right. Great, that was excellent.
Great film. So I'm really looking forward to anything by Morgan Neville.
Yeah, and it was 1969 that that Fred Rogers went in front of the committee, but I do think that the stuff with race relations and everything was really hugely important at the time, and we could use a little more of that today.
All right, our next documentary is the one I foisted on you. It's called Mountain. And when I saw you at Ocean's 8, I asked if you'd seen it, and I think we both immediately agreed. If you see Mountain, if you take the time to see Mountain, and if you climb mountains or have some affinity towards mountains, you have to see it in a movie theater, preferably on a very, very large IMAX screen like
Aaron. In a museum.
Yeah. it probably won't be at the Air and Space Museum because, you know, it's about mountains, but
you
never know.
It should be at, like, the Natural History Museum or
because
one of those.
Because this is visual mountain porn. You're just staring at these snow-capped mountains, and it's not, you know, what is a mountain. It's human history interacting with mountains. You know, humans didn't go up to mountains until we learned the 18th century, because before that, you could just sit in your living room and die. Why would you go to the mountains to die, too? I mean, life was already hard enough. And now, life is so easy and so boring, people have to go and be risky and try to kill themselves on mountains to feel alive. And that's just one of the themes I took out. There's a lot of themes told to us, voiced to us by Willem Dafoe, who comes across as like this god, omniscient narrator.
A Morgan Freeman
wannabe.
Yeah,
telling us about mountains. And behind him is the Australian Chamber Orchestra.
Oh, right.
And they're playing the hits. We're talking Vivaldi and Bach.
It's orchestra. It's scored to just classical
music. It's really pleasant to watch and listen to at the same time. And I didn't love this film, but I really got a kick out of it. I'm recommending it. And not even just to mountain lovers, just people that like to see pretty things.
It's amazing footage. I wonder exactly how they went about shooting this. It had to have been pretty phenomenal because they are showing you some pretty incredible stuff. I mean, you're talking about how all the different ways that people felt at some point that they needed to conquer the mountain and adventurers. So whether you're, you know, sort of doing the rock climbing thing or base jumping kind of thing or snowboarding on a mountain, it's fascinating to just kind of see all the different ways in which the mountain is being conquered by all these different groups of people. But it also kind of gives this impression that now humans are ruining this majestic.
We've gone from an age of exploration from the one or two people who attempt Everest to a time of queuing where you wait your turn to get to the summit.
And I think there was a gazillion, if I remember correctly, this movie had like 10 minutes of co-production on-screen credits before it even got underway. And one of them was like Sherpa Films. And I was like, oh, there's a Sherpa Films co-produced this.
Well, the director, Jennifer Petum, she directed a film before this called Sherpa. Oh, so she's staying in her wheelhouse here. It's not going to blow you away. It's not overly long. But it's just so unique.
Kind of
it's just so pretty.
And it's pretty.
You just want to listen to the music and Willem Dafoe. I got a kick out of this movie.
I didn't get as much a kick out of it as you. I liked it for the visuals, but all I could imagine was this is the kind of film that I absolutely think needs and deserves to be seen in that IMAX museum setting, or not even an IMAX. Like, if you're just
taking the kids, just a
nice big screen. But I think it is very much like a National Geographic vibe, and that's what you're getting. There's very little narrative here. It's the Willem Dafoe scripting is minimal.
At best. Because he's not overdoing it. There's only so much you can talk about mountains.
It's about the shots. It's about the sweeping shots and the cinematography, and the music.
Yeah.
And it is,
you put it all together and it just works.
Actually, or seeing it like at it. It would be really cool with a live orchestra on a giant lawn, like at a wolf trap kind of setting. That would be pretty cool, too.
All right, our last film, our sixth film, but our third documentary is the one you voiced it on to me, Nossa Chape. Hannah, why did I watch a documentary in Portuguese about Chapeco, Brazil? Not even just about Chapeco, Brazil, but about the Chapecoense Football Club. Why did I watch this film? What happened to them?
Because it's just this devastating story. And what happened was that the majority of this football, or as Americans would know it, is soccer team from Brazil. It's a Cinderella story that was going on with this team from this small town in Brazil that had made it to like one of the big tournaments and were flying to Medellin. And their plane crashed, and 19 players and the entire coaching staff all died. Like 21 journalists died, most of the crew died, and three players did manage to survive. There were like six total survivors out of 77 or so passengers or people that were on this flight. And so what this documentary did is they obviously recognized the filmmakers right away that we need to get into this town and sort of record and document how they recover from this tragedy involving this sports team that was like the lifeblood, had become the lifeblood of this town. And so it starts out as this kind of standard sports documentary and takes this turn about the rebuilding of this team and the difficulties of rebuilding this team. And I wanted you to watch it. I don't know if you're a soccer fan at all, but it is, it's definitely geared towards global soccer fans, because I think a lot of them who are World Cup fans and stuff might actually remember this story. It was only 2016, I think, that this plane crashed. And so it's a fairly recent, still very fresh kind of story. And I made you watch it mostly because I had already watched it, and therefore, you know, why should you get off the hook?
Chapeco, Brazil is only a town of 200,000 people. That's not very big. And to have their football team go from Series D to Series A in Soccer Mad Brazil is an incredible thing. So, of course, it is the lifeblood of the town. It's all they know. It's all they're famous for. And the documentary took a turn. I thought it was going to be about the plane crash, the widows, the orphans, they're all dead. But it's not. That's the first 20 minutes. It's actually about the tension, the strife of, okay, we're gonna put the band back together. We're gonna hire a new president, a new coach, all new players. You know, string the other three along because they're still all injured and can't play football right now. And it's the tension of out with the old, in with the new, but still kind of respect the old. Mm-hmm. And the fans are getting mad because all the new guys aren't coalescing yet and winning. And that's what most of the film is about. It's about the new 2017 soccer club. And that's an interesting way to do it. It's not wrong. It's not right. It's just how they chose to do it. And it ties it up in a nice little bow at the end of the season, and who, what happens to what people, what way they go. And it's directed, co-directed, Jeff and Michael Zimbalist. They do it. And they are Brazilian filmmakers, because I looked at their filmography. They did Favela Rising and Pelé, Birth of a Legend.
Ah, yes.
So they know Brazil and Brazil football. And yeah, I'm fine. I'm glad I watched it. I'm not a football nut. I'll watch, you know, the Seattle Sounders if they're on television, or the United States if they're in a World Cup, not this year. And, you know, I just appreciate a good sports story. And this is probably should have been like a 60 minutes sports segment.
ESPN 30 by 30. It does go a little long, but what's going to be interesting, because it was, it's a Fox Sports production, I believe. And so Fox, even though it's got a limited theatrical release, Fox Sports is actually going to show it. Fox is going to show it on June 23rd, following the World Cup coverage. Mm. And so that makes total sense.
It does.
And my guess is that they probably will have trimmed it down a bit by then, because it didn't need to be quite so long. I think what they were doing was they were trying to incorporate, I mean, the footage that they have, you know, they've got this footage of the burning wreckage and some of these players being wheeled into the hospital, the local hospital, and, you know, the social media stuff that you see, that, you know, here was this team that was so excited to be heading out to Medellin for this competition. And so when you've got all of that footage, you kind of, I think they felt like they really needed to show that in order to really make you care about the teammates that were lost, so that you could then be a little more understanding of why the efforts to sort of replace the teammates who had died just kind of goes off the rails a bit and doesn't necessarily work. And then when it does come back sort of full circle towards the end in a nice way. But yeah, I would have tightened it up in the middle.
All right, to recap our six films on this episode, Ocean's 8, which is about to make a whole bunch of money this weekend at the box office, I felt was a derivative knockoff and not worthy of the cast they got.
I disagree. I think it was a suitable knockoff worthy of the cast they got.
Hotel Artemis sounds fun just based on the cast.
Yeah, again, the cast rules for making this film work. And so I think if you really like a John Wick kind of franchise, then you'll probably appreciate this one. It is. It feels like a B-movie, but you enjoy it.
I really liked American Animals because of the filmmaking. The plot's okay. I've seen it before. But Bart Layton knows how to draw you in.
I liked it. It did draw me in, and I was with it, and I thought it was an interesting counterbalance. I saw them back to back. So I saw Ocean's 8 one day and American Animals the next, and that kind of makes for a rather fascinating double feature.
Won't You Be My Neighbors, coming hot on the heels of RBG, another documentary that is making far more money than anybody thought it would. And you're going to hear about Won't You Be My Neighbor for the rest of the year, probably, and into award season.
I hope so, because I really want as many people to see it as possible. It's not great filmmaking, but it's great messaging, and you gotta love Fred Rogers. And actually, what it does is it tells you that everything you saw from this guy, he actually really was that guy, and that's pretty cool.
Mountain is straight up mountain porn. It's nice to just sit back, watch, listen to, and another reminder that humans are also ruining mountains too.
I would wait to scale this one until you can actually see it on a big screen in a museum somewhere.
Nossa Chape is sad. It's overly long, but it's a good story.
And definitely, if you're a soccer fan, World Cup fever type person, and you remember at all anything about this air crash and just how devastating it was, then this is just a unique way to tell what otherwise would have seemed like a pretty standard sports story.
All right. Well, thank you very much for spending this time with the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend at RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.